Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Ki Tisa. This week, Neeman Novetzky discusses Ki Tisa. Please accept our apologies for some audio problems that happened during this podcast. And now, Neeman Novetzky, faculty member of Pardes.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha, Parshat Ki Tisa, has us finally moving away from the Parshiot that discussed the Mishkan or the Tabernacle, and takes a bit of a break to deal with perhaps one of the most famous stories in Tanakh, the story known as Chete Egel, the sin of the golden calf. It's a famous story, but one that raises many, many questions. To begin with, how do we understand the nature of the people's sin? The people have just witnessed the revelation at Sinai. It is a mere 40 days later, and already they're going and transgressing the first commandment not to believe in other gods. How do we understand this? Is that exactly what they're doing? Or perhaps, is there a different way to understand the sin? Second, how is it that Aaron, out of all people, the brother of Moshe, the person later chosen to be the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, is the one who allows or even helps the people to make this golden calf? How do we understand the role that he plays? And how do we understand the fact that the people fell so low, so soon after such a great event as the revelation at Sinai? I wanted to start by looking at three different approaches to the sin itself, then move into understanding Aaron, and finally, the people. Rashi, Rabbeinu Shlomo Yitzchaki, writes about the people's sin, that it was a simple sin of idolatry. When they say that we want to make a calf, asher yalchu lefanino, that should go before, he writes, elohot harbei ivulehem, they wanted many gods. For Rashi, the sin is a somewhat simple one to understand. This is pure idolatry. The people are turning their backs on God and deciding that they want a different God. Moshe's been away for 40 days. They start to fear. They feel uncertain. They don't know what's going on. And they rebel. They make an eagle. They make a calf. They bow down. They bring it korbanot. In his opinion, that all adds up to idolatry. They're going against the prohibition of God. Lo yalach Elohim acherim, do not have foreign gods. Even though it was just stated, here they're doing exactly that. They're falling back to the ways of the Egyptians from just a few months beforehand. As we said, many find such an approach troubling. If only because it's been so soon after revelation. How could you see God with your own eyes? And so soon afterwards, just because Moshe is a little late, right? The psukim say, the verses say, that after 40 days, Moshe was late in coming back, and all of a sudden the people panic. But why is that panic leading so soon to the turning of your back to God, to the choosing of other gods? This, amongst other things, is perhaps why others take a different approach, a different understanding of the verses. The second, perhaps most famous approach, is that of the Kuzari. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in his philosophical work, which he sets up as a discussion between a king and a sage, has the king ask, how is it that Bnei Yisrael did such a great sin? And he answers, in effect, by disagreeing with Rashi, and saying that the sin was not transgressing the law, lo yeh lach Elohim acherim, you shall not have other gods, but was rather a transgression of a similar sin, but a very different one. And that is the sin of lo ta'aseh lecha kol pesel, you should not make an idol. Let's read what he says inside and try to understand what he means by the distinction between the two. He writes, Chatam she Yisrael haya, the sin of Israel was, She'avru al azharat haborei, she'zhir lo la'asot pesel. They went against the warning of God that they shouldn't make an idol. Nusaf lekachatu, sheyichasu shefa Elohi amase yedehem, that they understood that there was some type of godly influence in their own handiwork, lelo mitzvah Elokim that wasn't commanded by God. He further explains what was going on here. What were the people's intention in making this golden calf and making this idol? And he says it wasn't because they wanted a different God. This was not the transgression of what we call Elohim Acherim, choosing other gods, but perhaps what we call Avodah Zarah, foreign worship, but foreign worship of our God. He says, what's the distinction between not making an idol, that prohibition, and not believing in other gods? The simple but very important fact that when one makes an idol, they might still believe in God. The only thing they're doing wrong is that they're making a physical representation of God. But it's not a lack of belief, just a wrong method of worship. He explains how this happens. Yisrael chiku l'kiyum haftachat Moshe sheftichem lehorid lahem eze inyan muhashi me'it Hashem. He says, what happened? There was revelation. Moshe then left for 40 days. And what he leave to do? He left to go bring back, as he promised, some tangible thing from God. The tablets. Shiyir uhu, something that they could see. V'yachavnu pnehem negdo, and they could turn their faces towards it. Kidugmat amud ha'anan, just like they used to have the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire as they left Egypt. Shehibitu elav v'yishtachavu negdo le'elohim. They would look at these two things, the cloud and the fire, and they would bow down towards it, but really with the intention of bowing down towards the glory of God, towards God that lay behind it. So too, they're waiting and waiting and waiting for these tablets. They need something tangible. But Moshe doesn't come down. He's late. And so what do? They decide, then fine, we'll make some tangible representation of God instead. And they make the eagle, they make the calf. But again, their intentions are somewhat pure. They really believe that they're worshiping God, not that they're worshiping some other god, some calf. The Kuzari would probably explain Aaron's words, Chag LaHashem Machar. When Aaron goes and makes the calf, he tells the people, we're going to celebrate to God tomorrow. That the people really believed that. They looked at the calf and they said, yes, tomorrow through the calf, we're not going to be celebrating some calf. We're going to be celebrating God. That's a second approach. This approach also, though, bothers many, because even if their intentions were good, it still has been a mere 40 days since they heard, Lo tasel achapesel, you shall not make for yourself an idol. Have they forgotten so soon? And so, we get an approach that suggests that the sin here had nothing to do with rebellion against God, misrepresentation of God, with neither Lo yelach Elohim acherim, you shall not have other gods, nor lo ta'aseh lecha kol pesel, you shall not make for yourself an idol. But rather, this had something to do with replacing Moshe as leader. This approach is taken by the Ramban. We'll look at him inside. He says, Ma tam yomru, kivan shehalach Moshe mimenu, na'aseh Elohim. He says, if you look at the wording of the people, they turn to Aaron and they turn to each other and they say, look, Moshe's late. He's nowhere to be found. He left. So let's make us a new god. And he says, one doesn't lead to the other. Why, just because Moshe left, would you come to the conclusion that you need a new god? So what is it that the people mean? So he says, Hayu mevakshin Moshe acher. They weren't looking for a new God. They were looking for a new Moshe. Amru, Moshe shehora lanu haderach mimitzrayim badhina. Moshe who taught us the way, showed us the way from Egypt until now. Hine avad mimenu. He's lost. Nase lanu Moshe acher sheyoreh haderach. Let's go look and replace Moshe with a new one to show us the way. V'zetam hizkiram Moshe ha'isha sher ha'alanu. That's why when they speak and they say, where is Moshe? They say, Moshe, the person who took us out, he's no longer. They don't mention God who took us out. Let's go replace God. Because they haven't lost God. What they have lost, at least so they think, is Moshe. He hasn't yet come down from that mountain. He must be dead. If so, let's replace him. And here one can go in one of two ways. What does it mean to replace Moshe with a golden calf? So one could say that some of the people actually perhaps saw in Moshe some type of a godly figure, and they're looking to replace Moshe, that godly figure, with a new godly figure, the calf. Others suggest that no. They recognize that Moshe was a prophet. They never confused him with God. And what they're looking for is a new medium through which to reach God. And coming from an Egyptian background, they come to the conclusion that, yes, perhaps we can go make some type of a golden calf, a medium through which we can get to God, and that new medium, this calf, will somehow guide us in our way. If one takes this approach, so yes, it definitely lessens the sin of the people. It is no longer a sin against God, but a sin against, perhaps, Moshe. But an unintentional sin, because they don't at all believe that they're rebelling against Moshe. They truly believe that Moshe is not coming back, and they simply want a new leader. But once again, they simply err in the method. So those are three different approaches to the sin. All of them, though, still make us wonder about Aaron.
So how do we understand Aaron's role in this entire sin? The commentators bend over backwards to try to understand where he was coming from, what he was thinking, what he was doing, and to try to absolve him from as much guilt as possible. Ibn Ezra himself, in explaining this story, quotes quite a few different possible ways of interpreting or understanding Aaron, most of which he rejects, but the possibilities, I think, are still interesting to listen to and at least express the strong desire of the various commentators to see Aaron in a positive light, despite the negative that comes out from the story itself. So the first approach quoted in Ibn Ezra is, Yesh omrim, there are those that say, Ki zeh Aharon einenu achi Moshe. There are those that say this Aaron is not the brother of Moshe. So this is, of course, a quite far-reaching possibility to say that the Aaron mentioned in our story Aaron. There's no way that the brother of Moshe would have aided the people in potential idolatry. And if so, perhaps this is just simply another person by the same name. Not the Aaron of Moshe, but some other Aaron that was a person in the nation who helped all of the people do this sin. Ibn Ezra rejects this possibility, saying, doesn't make any sense. How could the Tanakh possibly leave it even slightly ambiguous? If this is really a different Aaron, then why lead 95% of the people, as they read the text, to think that it's the Aaron, the brother of Moshe? If it was really a different Aaron, the text should have gone out of its way to tell us who this other Aaron is. And so Ibn Ezra brings another possibility. And he says, there are those who, from a logical standpoint, suggest, Ki ra'a Aharon sheneharag Chor. Aaron saw that Chor had been killed, Akein pachad va'asa ha'egel, and therefore he feared, and he made the eagle, he made the golden calf. According to this approach, one needs a little bit of background to understand where Aaron was coming from. When Moshe first went up to the mountain after receiving the Decalogue, in order to receive the tablets, he appointed two people in his place, Aaron and another person named Hor. After that appointment, we never hear of Hor again in the Psukim. It is only Aaron who plays any role after that. This leads many to suggest that something must have happened to Hor. Otherwise, why did he disappear? And what they suggest is that the people, in their frenzy and their panic and their desire for some replacement to Moshe, actually had Hur killed. And according to this approach, the only reason that Aaron in the end aided the people in making the idol and making the calf was because he feared for his life. He saw Hur killed and he was scared, I'm next in line. And so he gave in to the people. Ebenezer rejects this approach as well, saying, if this is Aaron, brother of Moshe, he should have been willing to give his life instead of aiding the people in potential idolatry. And how could it be possible that if Aaron really helped them do idolatry, even if it was on fear of death, that he was later appointed to be the high priest? And so Ibn Ezra brings one last approach based on the thought of Rav Sadia Gaon. The Omar HaGaon, Kidat Aaron Haita LeGalot Sod of the Avodah Zarah. According to Rav Sadia Gaon, what were Aaron's intentions in this entire episode? Not to worship idolatry, not to allow the people to worship idolatry, but rather to reveal those who were worshiping idolatry. He suggests that the entire thing that Aaron set up wasn't to aid the people, but was to go and sort of trap them so that those who believed in other gods, who wanted to worship the calf, would be able to do so just so that they can afterwards get punished. He brings a parallel to a similar story that takes place in the Book of Kings by a person named Jehu, who also goes and calls out to the people, and he says to them, whoever wants to go and worship idolatry, follow me. And all of these people go and follow him, and then he goes and burns them all alive. And so Rav Sadia Gaon suggests Aaron here had pure intentions. He wasn't trying to aid anyone. He was trying to make sure that the right people get punished for their actions. Rashi goes in a slightly different direction. He too wants to absolve Aaron as of much guilt as possible. And so he suggests that almost all of Aaron's actions can be understood as an attempt to push off this act. Perhaps Aaron himself wasn't strong enough a leader to stop the people by himself from worshiping an idol. And so Aaron was hoping that he could push the people off enough until Moshe came down from the mountain, at which point the people would stop by themselves, or Moshe would help him to stop them. So he suggests, for example, that when Aaron asked the people to take away the gold from their earrings and all of their different jewelry in order to mold it into the gold that will be used for the calf, his intention isn't to get the gold, but rather to have them take a long time to give him that gold. He says, Hanashim ba'iladim chasim al tachshikim. Amar Aaron b'libo, shema yitakev hadavar, u'betoch kach yavo Moshe. He says, what was Aaron thinking? Women, children, they like their jewelry. They're not going to let it go so easily. He was hoping that by suggesting this way of donating towards the calf, it would take hours and hours before the people actually gave him any gold. They'd be fighting at home and saying no, 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 until finally they gave it, perhaps Moshe would have already come down from the mountain. Similarly, he says, Vayiven Mizbeach, why does he build an altar? Not to help them worship, but because building an altar takes time. It takes hours. And perhaps, again, in one of those hours, Moshe would finally come down. Last, when he has nothing else left to push them off with, Aaron says, Chag l'Hashem machar. Let's celebrate tomorrow, not today, again, hoping that by morning, perhaps Moshe will have returned. The Rabbal takes a similar approach to Rashi, but he suggests that Aaron was trying to push the people off, trying to buy time, but this wasn't a matter of a few hours, not a matter of a day until Moshe would come back, but a matter of weeks. How does that work? So Rabbah says, lots of times when we read Tanakh, we, being omniscient readers, forget that that even though we know the end of the story, the people living it did not. We, having read Tanakh, knew that when Moshe went up to the mountain, he stayed there for 40 days. But the people in the time of Tanakh, perhaps, had no idea how long Moshe was going to be up that mountain for. When he leaves, perhaps they think he's going to come back tomorrow, or in 2 days, or in 3 days. They never dream that he's going to be there for 40 days. And so Rabag suggests that already on day 3 or 4 of Moshe's stay on the mountain, the people start to panic. The people fear, maybe Moshe died. Maybe something happened to him up on that mountain. Maybe he's never going to come back. And already on day 3 or 4, they start to ask Aaron for a replacement. According to this approach, then, Aaron doesn't just push the people off for a few hours. He's actually successful in pushing them off for 3 weeks or more. According to Rabag, then, Aaron comes out a much more positive character. True, he doesn't manage in the end to push them off totally. True, we would have liked a stronger character that could somehow have made sure that they weren't going to make any type of idol, never sin at all. But at least according to Rabag, Aaron was someone who for at least a few weeks was able to push the people off and was successful in it until the very end. No matter which approach you take, unfortunately, Aaron doesn't ever seem to come off scot-clean. His intentions might have been pure. He himself, perhaps, never thought at all of ever worshiping anyone except for God. But nonetheless, in the end, under his leadership, the people do fail. At least, though, Aaron himself doesn't seem to have believed in idols, but to have remained true in his own beliefs to God. That, though, we can't so simply say about the people. And we return to the question we had asked earlier. How do we understand how the people, so soon after Matan Torah, so soon after getting the commandments, Lo yelech Elohim achirim, you shall not have other gods, Lo ta'aseh lecha kol pesel, you shall not make for yourself an idol. How could they, no matter which understanding we take of the sin, how could they have made the calf? So here too, there are several approaches to our question. Some suggest, don't think that the entire nation worshiped the calf. Only some of them did. And again, this is a question of how we sometimes read Tanakh, making assumptions that aren't true. We tend to read the story and say, oh, everyone was a participant. It's very possible that just a few people were participants, a few thousand from the over 1 million people that were in the desert. A second approach is to say that our thinking is all wrong. We say, how could they have worshipped the calf so soon after Matan Torah? But perhaps, along the lines of the Kuzari, perhaps it is Dafka Matan Torah, specifically the revelation at Sinai, that led them to the need to make a calf. Having that revelation, being able for a moment to glimpse God, to really see and appreciate God, led to a desire for more. It's hard to have it all and then have nothing. And perhaps it was that being able to see God that led for the need for something tangible, for something they could touch, for something they could see. And that perhaps was one of the reasons that they failed and made the calf. There's one last approach to our question.
He says, "Nir'ah sherotzah ha'Torah l'lamdeinu ul'harot dugma l'dorot." She says, "The Torah perhaps wanted to teach us a lesson for generations." Shedavar zeh yitachein, that exactly what we think is impossible isn't just possible, but likely. Etzem ha'hanacha shebnei adam asher amdu ragleim b'tachtit har Sinai inam yicholim, inam misugalim od lishkoa b'be'avut b'chsilut. She says, the very assumption that we have that people who stood at the bottom of that mountain who viewed God would no longer be able to fall into the depths of stupidity, to fall into the abominations of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry. That assumption, she says, is totally wrong. Ein nisim gluyim. Revealed miracles. Mara'ot niflaim chad pamim. One-time wondrous events. Inam mishanim et hadam. Those types of things don't change man. Et tivo, et hergalav. They don't change his nature. They don't change his customs. Him rak mizazim oto b'oto rega. They just move him for that one moment. Ach ein him minatkim oto me'lamo. But they don't uproot him from his world. Me'evro, from his past. Me'hergalei chayav, from the customs of his life. Lachein lo nitma. And therefore, we should not be surprised. Ela nilmad v'nasim alev, but we should listen and learn. Sheshloshet alefim ish mibin eila sherem juragleim b'tachti tahar, that 3,000 people who had stood at that mountain and listened to the voice of God, halchu acharei arbeim yom v'asu ega, 40 days later, made a calf. Ki lo hashmiya hachad tamit hiho hofechet ha'adam, because it's not a one-time listening, a one-time event that changes man. It makes him go from one extreme to another. Not even if that one-time listening is from God himself. It's only over an extended period of time, learning and keeping mitzvot, that a person will change. So I want to end with these words of Nechama, because I think that Nechama is really saying a very important point here. Sometimes we think one-time huge events, they're what changes our lives forever. And Nechama says, no, that's not true. It's very possible that 40 days after revelation, human nature is, you fall back into your own ways. Miracles don't change you overnight. What changes you is lengthy processes, is the doing every day, is the continued doing, the continued learning. And so I wish all of us that continued doing and continued learning to change us into the best people that we could be. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Naima. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org with any comments. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.